You are listening to a sermon by Derek Carr, recorded on Sunday, July 27, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Just reflecting on the words of the last of the Psalms that we just listened to. If indeed the days of our life are 70 years, then this might be my last performance. Now, I'm going to be showing some pictures. I don't know, you may not be able to see. I'm going to sort of reshuffle briefly for about 45 minutes. I call this presentation Velázquez's Holy Hermits, and of course it picks up on the theme that Evan has introduced and which has been part of this morning's service: contemplation, the nature of prayer, and our participation in it. Now, just a little bit of sort of egoism to begin with. One of the genetic propensities that my two brothers and my two children have inherited from my father's side of the family is a certain knack in the creative arts. And art of one sort or another was very much part of my upbringing, both in and out of school when I was young, and also in combination subsequently with my interest in things Spanish. It led me many, many years ago to a fascination with and a profound admiration for the work of a certain, are you ready for it, Don Diego Rodríguez de Silva y Velázquez, known generally to English-speaking art historians as Velázquez. They always pronounce it wrong. Here he is, the painter of painters, portrayer of truth, and prisoner of the king, as one of his English-speaking biographers calls him. And a Spanish biographer describes him as un pájaro solitario. Now, this term in Spanish conveys the same idea as the North American expression a lone wolf, a loner. In Spanish, pájaro solitario means a solitary bird. And I'd like you to keep that meaning in mind as I speak to you this morning. And just a brief bit of history, and then we'll go into some art and a bit of linguistics and then some contemplation about hermits. Velázquez was born in 1599. He was the son of a certain Juan Rodríguez de Silva and his mother Jerónima Velázquez. And he was always known by his mother's surname, which is not the norm in Spanish, but probably because his father's name, Rodríguez, was more common, and also de Silva wasn't Spanish. It was Portuguese, and it means a bush. The white cross, which you can see painted on the tunic here, is the symbol of the Orden de Santiago, the Honorary Order of St. James, which was a Spanish order of knighthood. And according to one tradition, the cross was painted on the artist's tunic by the order of the king, Philip IV, perhaps even by the king himself, according to some accounts. This would have been after Velázquez's death in 1660. Now, when he painted this piece, which is part of Las Meninas, which I'll show you in a moment, he was not yet a knight of the Order of St. James. And his elevation to that rank was delayed for quite some time. And we might ask why. Well, there were various issues involved, but most of it had to do with Velázquez's ancestors on his father's side of the family. That is the surname Rodríguez de Silva, the de Silva bit, just like Pereira for Pereira, Rosie, would automatically trigger alarms in the offices of the Spanish Inquisition, because it was a surname frequently adopted by the Portuguese conversos, that is, converts from Judaism. And having Jewish ancestors would disqualify you from admission into any of the Spanish orders of knighthood. But De Silva was not necessarily an indication of Jewish ancestry. But it took the Inquisition's investigators quite a long time to come to the conclusion that in Velázquez's case, he was in fact descended from Portuguese nobility. Nevertheless, two papal dispensations were also required before the honorary knighthood could be granted, because painters were members of a social class that was also excluded from elevation to that rank of knighthood. Now, the casual observer of Spanish art would probably know the brilliant painting of Las Meninas. You'll have seen it, I'm sure, in reproductions. And the portrait that you just saw is just a detail here. It's a very big canvas, and it's in the Prado Museum. I'll just go through it just so you know what's going on. Left to right, you've got the artist himself, who, when you think about it, shouldn't really be there. Then we have a lady in waiting. She is una menina, a little lady, a lady in waiting, hence the name of the painting. Then we've got the princess, the infanta, Margarita Teresa, who was about 5 or 6 years old at the time, and who at the age of 15, I think it was married off to the Holy Roman Emperor, who was around 50. And they had about 3 or 4 children together. She had several miscarriages and was dead at 21. Another lady in waiting here, Isabel de Velasco, no relation to Velázquez. Then we have two dwarfs who were commonplace in the Spanish court. They tended to look after people, kids who were cast out from their families because of superstition concerning their deformities of one sort or another. This one, the girl, is Mari Bárbola, who was in fact German, and then a little boy called Nicolás Pertusato, whose name suggests that he might have been Italian. Then there's an absolutely super splendid dog right up front. And behind the front are, in the doorway, the chamberlain, Don José Nieto. And then we have a widow called Marcela Ulloa here, who was a sort of nanny to the princess. And then there's an unnamed guardadamas, a sort of chaperone. And on the far wall, over here, we see the king and queen. And the question is still not answered. Is it a portrait? Or is it a reflection in a mirror? And it's an interesting example of what I would call a Baroque inversion, in which the most important people in the room are represented only second-hand, as it were, on the back wall. But it's not this that I want to talk about today. What I'd like to do is to say a few words about one of Velázquez's works, which is once atypical and rather enigmatic. Number 3, please, Peter. It's a very large canvas, 8'6" by 6'2", and it occupies a very prominent position in the Prado Museum in Madrid. It's called in Spanish Los Santos Ermitaños, the Holy Hermits, or San Antonio Abad y San Pablo Ermitaño, Saint Anthony Abbot and Saint Paul the Hermit. And one of the reasons I want to talk to you about this is that thanks to my interest and training in philology, the love of words, I think I've solved one of the problems that has occupied art historians for some time, namely the location of the landscape, which occupies most of the painting and dominates the scene. Now, this painting is atypical for various reasons. First of all, because of the very evident expression of religious devotion, which you see in the figures of the two hermits in the foreground. Now, religious themes are relatively rare in Velázquez's work, viewed as a whole, and the majority of the few religious paintings that he did undertake tend to be fairly conventional. There's little evidence of any deep personal religiosity or commitment on Velázquez's part. And we also know from the inventory that was made of his library after he died that religious and devotional works, and even literary works, were conspicuous by their absence. Whereas books on art theory, mathematics, geography, mechanics, anatomy and architecture abounded. And there were also one or two emblem books, books on pictorial allegorical representations, and also some works on mythology. And the other atypical feature of this work is that it's the only one of Velázquez's paintings in which he has used an essentially medieval narrative technique. And what I mean by this is that within the framework of this single picture, there are in fact various narrative episodes that take place at different times and in different locations. So what is going on here? Well, we know that the basic inspiration for this painting comes from a literary source, a book called the Legenda Sanctorum, the Legends of the Saints, or the also known as the Legenda Aurea, the Golden Legends. And this was a collection of legendary, and I stress the word legendary, lives of the saints of the early Christian Church, compiled by a certain Jacobus de Voragine, who was the Archbishop of Genoa in Italy in the 13th century. And I should perhaps point out, being an academic, that the good Archbishop did not invent the story that we are dealing with here. It's actually been lifted from a medieval encyclopedia and can be traced back at least as far as St. Isidore of Seville in the late 6th, early 7th century, and he probably got it from a Greek source. In those days, plagiarism was not such a big no-no as it is these days. Now, the story itself concerns the life of St. Paul. Now, we're not referring here to the great anti-feminist convert of the New Testament, but a different St. Paul, namely St. Paul the Hermit, late 3rd and early 4th century. He was one of the so-called desert fathers, and in fact the first of the early Christian hermits to dwell alone in the Thebaid desert of Egypt. And according to the Legenda Aurea and its earlier sources, St. Anthony, the abbot of an early monastic community, and none other than the St. Anthony of the Temptations, depicted by Salvador Dalí, among others, he was tempted yet again. On this occasion, he was not assailed by erotic visions, but was tempted by the devil to vainglory or pride, at the age of 90, by the thought that he was the very first hermit in the desert. And he was then visited in a dream by an angel of light, who successfully punctured this bubble of self-satisfaction. So we pick up the story now from the very picturesque English translation of the Golden Legend, done in 1483 by William Caxton, the pioneer of printing in England. And it goes as follows. Hereupon came to him, St. Anthony, a revelation as he slept, that beneath all, low down in the desert, was an hermit better than he, and that he ought to go and see this holy man. Anon, after the next day, he took his staff by which he assisted him, and began to go through that desert. And it happened that he met a person which was halfway above an horse, and beneath a man, whom the fables of the poets call centaurs. Peter, next one, please. Now, down at the far left-hand corner of the painting, you see the meeting with the centaur. And then it goes on. And anon St. Anthony made before him the sign of the cross, and demanded of him where this holy man the hermit dwelt. And the centaur showed him the way on the right side, and anon vanished away from him. After this St. Anthony met with a monster in a valley bearing the fruit of the palm tree, crooked, and he had in his forehead horns, and his legs and feet like a goat of the woods. And anon he made before him the sign of the cross. There's the figure here. And St. Anthony demanded what he was, and he answered, I am mortal, and I dwell in the desert, and the Saracens call me Sacraros, that is, a satyr, half goat, half man. St. Anthony had great labor in going by the desert where there was no way. Now, can you... a long push, so it'll go back. Okay, just one shot. Thank you. Great. Finally, he found a she-wolf. Somewhere in there. I can't quite see it, but she's there. Which brought him by the will of God unto the hermitage of St. Paul. So St. Anthony arrives at the cave of the 113-year-old St. Paul. 133-year-old St. Paul, and he knocks on the door. You can see it going on in there. He persuades the old man to come out, and the two saints sit and converse of holy things and pray together, and at midday a crow or a raven comes down from heaven bearing a round loaf of bread in its beak and feeds them. And finally, in the bottom left of the painting, we see the last episode of the legend, the death of St. Paul. St. Anton prays over the old man, the old hermit's mortal remains, and then he buries them in a grave, conveniently dug by a pair of passing lions. And as Captain's version so quaintly puts it, then came two lions, which, much debonairly, made a pit after the quantity of his body, and St. Anthony buried his body therein. So this, then, is the basic story, which obviously, I think, to a certain extent, is a Christianization of the Old Testament story of the prophet Elijah and his disciple Eliseus in Latin, fed by the ravens in the desert. You find this in the third book of Kings. Or, in other words, the story is an attempt to invest the early Christian hermits with the same sort of identity and prophetic authority as the Old Testament figures. Now, I don't want to go into a great deal of detail on the historical aspects of the painting, the art history, but on the basis of the research that I've done into the life and works of Velázquez, I think that this painting was done in 1660, not long before Velázquez died. And I think that the landscape was inspired by the rocky pass in northern Spain through which Velázquez journeyed and in whose castle he stayed for several days while on royal business in that year. Although already in ill health, he'd been dispatched by the king from Madrid to the French border in the Basque country to a place called the Isle of Pheasants, which is in the river which divides Spain from France. And he went there to make arrangements for a reception during which Philip IV of Spain was to give his daughter Maria Teresa in marriage to King Louis XIV of France. So she then became the not entirely happy Queen Marie-Thérèse de France. And I think that the rocky pass in question is the Pass of Pan Corvo. So Peter, if you can jump two ahead. This I took on a terribly cloudy day, so it's not all that clear, but you can get the idea of the landscape. And then another one. And there's an interesting thing in the pass, a hole in the rock. It's called La Horadada, if you like, La Roche Percée. And in Velázquez's day, it would have been deeper. The road, the air has been filled up consistently over the years to make roadways. And then another one. And this is the northern edge of the pass, and this rock, I think, is rather interesting. Can you do another one, please? You see, very similar to the rock that we've got in the painting. So if you can do the long pushes to go back to number three again. And again. And again. And one more. And again. And there we are, thank you. And I think that Velázquez tells us that it's the Pass of Pan Corvo by a rather nice example of a visual Baroque conceit. Now, the bird we see in the painting is a cuervo from the Latin corvus, which gives us the English word crow and the Scots word corvi. And bread in Spanish is pan, from Latin panis. And if we put these two elements together, we come very close to the place name, Pan Corvo. And as it happens, local legend had already made the connection between pan and cuervo long before Velázquez's day, claiming that two crows, like those of the prophet Elijah, came to bring bread to certain Christians who'd been walled up in the village by the Moors. Hence the popular etymology of the place name, Villa Panis Corvi, which you might translate as something like Crow Breadville. Now, there's an evident aura, I think, of personal introspection in the various thematic elements that this painting represents. The journey, the spiritual quest, the transfer of the mantle of authority, and, of course, death itself. And if this work does in fact get its inspiration from the last journey that Velázquez made in 1660, then the crow, I think, acquires a certain symbolic value. In the first place, I think it identifies the spot in which Velázquez sketched the landscape in which he will situate his version of the legend of St. Anthony Abbot and St. Paul the Hermit. And the crow, of course, as we know, can also be a symbol of death or of evil fortune. And we have but to think, I think, of the gruesome Anglo-Scottish ballad of the Twa Corbies, in which a pair of the loathsome birds systematically plan the dismemberment of the corpse of a new slain knight. In Spanish folklore, the crow was also a bird of augury or divination, consulted by travellers before they set out on a journey. If the crow flies from the right as you go out of the front door, then it's a good omen, a propitious start to your journey. If it comes from the left, it's an evil portent, and it's probably best not to go out. In our painting, of course, it's ambivalent. We, the spectators, see it approaching from the left, a sign of death in the Spanish tradition, yet for the two saints it comes from the right, a sign of life and hope. So how can we sort of reconcile this with the impending death of St. Paul? Well, in the context of the story of the prophet Elijah, biblical commentaries interpret the crow or the raven as a symbol of divine providence. In heraldry, it symbolizes constancy and long life. And in the pre-Christian classical tradition, the crow was a bird sacred to Apollo, the sun god, which raises the possibility, I think, that Velázquez may be making an oblique reference to his relationship to the king. The bread that the bird carries in its beak is, of course, earthly food to sustain the scant physical needs of the two hermit saints. But in Christian symbolism, it's also the Eucharist, the Panis Angelicus, the Viaticum, which nourishes the soul in its final journey towards its Creator. So the gloomy symbol of death becomes at the same time a symbol of hope in the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. An American art historian called Madeline Milner Carr, and she's no relation to me, her name is spelled K-A-H-R, she sums up this painting as follows. She says, "Exalted religious sentiment has rarely been so perfectly expressed by its artistic equivalent. It's a visualization of the spiritual beauty of simplicity and renunciation that is the heart of the legend of the old hermit saints whose faith alone sustains them." Now, I've been trying to go a little bit further than this and suggest that it represents one of the most accomplished artistic expressions of man's intimation of his own mortality. It is as if the painter was saying, "Here am I on my own last via crucis, way of the cross. Timor mortis conturbat me, the fear of death affrights me. I can't go on. Consummatum est, it is finished." Velázquez died on August 6th, 1660, a month after returning to Madrid from the Basque country. So finally, I'm going to leave you with a short philological or linguistic footnote, which I can't resist, followed by a religious question for you to think about, and which we've already started to think about since the beginning of this morning's gathering. First of all, here's the linguistic footnote, harking back to the description of Velázquez as un pájaro solitario, a solitary bird. In Spanish, the surname Velázquez is the patronymic, the father's name, which derives from Velasco. That is, Velázquez means son of Velasco, just as Rodríguez means son of Rodrigo, Roderick, Sánchez, son of Sancho, Pérez, son of Pedro, Pedro, Peter, and so on. In his authoritative history of the Spanish language, the late Professor Rafael Lapesa tells us that the name Velasco itself was originally a toponym, a place name, that it is pre-Roman and of Ligurian origin, and that the element vela in Velasco, and hence in Velázquez, means nothing less than, dramatic pause, a crow. Coincidence? I don't know. Now, in a purely academic setting, this is where I would stop. But let's return briefly to the story that is illustrated in this painting. And here's my question. What is actually achieved by living the solitary life of a hermit? Is it a purely self-centered and possibly self-indulgent activity in which the anchorite concentrates solely on his or her own spiritual well-being and salvation? Or do we poor sinners actually benefit from the hermit's prayers and self-sacrifice when they are offered up on our behalf, if in fact they are? Is the active life, in which prayer and good works combine, a more balanced way of developing and expressing our spirituality? And how do we achieve the balance between the spiritual gifts of the Holy Spirit, the charismata, which are to be used for the benefit of others, and the fruits of the Spirit and other gifts which result in personal sanctification? Or is it ultimately a question of each one to his or her own taste and capability? As St. Paul says, there are many gifts of the Holy Spirit, but we may not have them all in equal proportion. Now, even though, as Evan has reminded you, I am a Catholic of the Roman rather than Anglo variety, I have no dogmatic answer to all this, and I would be very interested to hear about other people's experiences and thoughts on this topic. So I thank you yet again for your patience, and as I say, this might be my last appearance. Thank you very much.